Disc 11.
He sets down the otoscope and picks up the ophthalmoscope. He peers into her eyes, his face inches from hers. Then he gets the stethoscope. Lucy lets herself be afraid, even though she is more angry than afraid. In fact, she isn't afraid at all, she realizes, as she sits on the edge of the examination table, and paper crinkles softly whenever her weight shifts even slightly. "If you'll just unzip your flight suit and pull it down to your waist," he says in the same matter-of-fact tone. Lucy just looks at him. Then she says,
"I think I need to use the ladies' room again. I'm sorry."
"Go ahead," he says rather impatiently, "but I'm running late." She hurries to the bathroom and is in and out in less than a minute, the toilet flushing in her wake, the receiver back in her ear.
"Sorry," she says again. "I drank a big Diet Coke right before I got here. Mistake."
"Pull down your flight suit," he orders her. She hesitates. Now the challenge comes, but she knows what to do. Unzipping her flight suit, she pulls it down to her waist, manipulating the position of the pen so it is angled just right, the wire connected to the cellular interface taped on the inside of the flight suit and not visible.
"Not quite so vertical,"
Benton's voice is in her ear.
"Angled down maybe 10 degrees.
She subtly adjusts the top of the flight suit that is around her waist, and Dr. Paulson says,
"Your sports bra, too."
"I have to take it off?"
she asks timidly, scared.
"I never have before."
"Miss Winston, I really am in a hurry. Please."
He tucks the stethoscope earpieces into his ears, his face stern as he moves close, waiting to listen to her heart and lungs. And she pulls her sports bra over her head and sits very still, frozen on top of the white paper-lined table. He presses the stethoscope under one breast, then the other, touching her as she sits very still. She is breathing rapidly, her heart racing, registering her anger, not fear. But she knows he thinks she is afraid, and she wonders what images Benton is picking up. Subtly, she adjusts the flight suit around her waist, touching the pen camera, as Dr. Paulson touches her and pretends he has no interest in what he is seeing and feeling.
10 degrees down to the right, Benton instructs her.
Subtly, she adjusts the pen, and Dr. Paulson leans her forward and moves over her back with the stethoscope.
"Deep breaths," he is saying.
And he is quite skilled at doing his job while he manages to touch and brush against and even cup his hands around as he presses against her, hard.
"Do you have any scars or birthmarks? I'm not seeing any."
He runs his hands over her, looking.
"No, sir,"
she says.
"You must have something. From an appendectomy, maybe? Anything?"
"No."
"That's enough,"
Benton says in Lucy's ear, and she detects anger in his calm tone. But it's not enough.
"I need you to get up now and stand on one foot," Dr. Paulson says.
"Can I dress?"
"Not yet." "That's enough,"
Benton's voice sounds in her ear.
"Stand up," Dr. Paulson orders her.
Lucy sits on the table and pulls up her flight suit, working her arms into the sleeves and zipping it up, not bothering with her bra, because she doesn't have time. She stares at him, and suddenly she is no longer acting nervous or afraid, and he sees the change in her, and his eyes react. She gets off the table and steps close to him.
"Sit down,"
she tells him.
"What are you doing?"
His eyes widen.
"Sit down!"
He doesn't move, staring at her. As is typical of every bully she's ever met, he looks scared. She moves in to frighten him more, pulling the pen out of her breast pocket, lifting it up so he can see the attached wire.
"Freak test,"
she says to Benton, because he can check the concealed transmitter she planted in the waiting room in the kitchen downstairs.
"Clear,"
he comes back.
"Good," she thinks. He isn't picking up on any sounds downstairs. "You don't even want to know how much trouble you're in,"
Lucy says to Dr. Paulson.
"You don't even want to know who's watching and listening to all of this in real time, live. Sit down. Sit down!"
She returns the pen to her pocket, its hidden lens looking right at him. He moves unsteadily, fumbles with a chair, rolls it out from the counter and sits, looking at her, his face white.
"Who are you? What are you doing?"
"I'm your destiny, motherfucker,"
Lucy says to him. And she tries to will her rage back into its cage, but it is easier for her to will herself to seem scared than it is for her to will her rage into submission.
You do that sort of shit with your daughter? With Jilly? You molest her too, you son of a bitch?
He stares at her, his eyes wild.
You heard me. You heard me loud and clear, asshole. The FAA's gonna hear you soon enough, too.
Get out of my office.
He is thinking of grabbing her. She can see it in the tensed muscles of his body, in his eyes.
Don't try it, Lucy warns him. Don't think of moving out of that chair until I tell you to. When was the last time you saw Jilly?
What is this about? The rose,
Benton cues her.
I'm the one asking questions, Lucy tells Dr. Paulson,
and a part of her wants to tell Benton the same thing.
Your ex-wife is spreading stories around. Did you know that, Dr. Homeland Security snitch?
He wets his lips, his eyes wide and frantic.
She's making a pretty good case for you being the reason Jilly's dead. Did you know that?
The rose,
Benton sounds in her ear.
She says you came to see Jilly not long before she suddenly died. You brought her a rose. Oh, we know about it. Everything in that poor little girl's room has been gone through. Trust me.
A rose was in her room? Get him to describe it, Benton says.
You tell me,
Lucy says to Dr. Paulson.
Where'd you get the rose?
I didn't. I don't know what you're talking about.
Don't waste my time.
You're not going to the FAA.
Lucy laughs and shakes her head.
Oh, assholes like you are cut out with a cookie cutter. You really think you'll get away with your shit. You really think it. Talk to me about Jilly. Then we'll talk about the FAA.
Turn it off,
he indicates the camera pen.
You tell me about Jilly, I'll turn it off.
He nods. She touches the pen and pretends she's turning it off. His eyes are scared and don't trust her.
The rose,
she repeats.
I swear to God, I don't know anything about a rose, he replies. I would never hurt Jilly. What is she saying? What is that bitch saying?
Yes, Susanna,
Lucy stares at him.
She has a lot to say. The way she tells it, you're the reason Jilly's dead. Murdered.
No. Good God, no.
You play soldier with Jilly, too? You dress her up in camouflage and boots, asshole? You let perverts in your house to play your sick little games?
Oh, God, he groans, shutting his eyes. That bitch. It was between us.
Us?
Suze and me. Couples do things.
And who else? You have other people over playing your games?
It was my private home.
What a pig you are,
Lucy says menacingly.
Doing shit like that in front of a little girl.
Are you FBI?
He opens his eyes, and they look dead with hate, like shark eyes.
You are, aren't you? I knew it would happen. I should have known, as if my life has to do with anything. I knew it. I've been set up.
I see. The FBI forced you to make me take my clothes off for a routine flight physical.
It has nothing to do with anything. It doesn't matter.
I beg to differ, she replies sarcastically. It matters, all right. You're going to find out just how much it matters. I'm not the FBI. You aren't that lucky.
This is all about Jilly?
He is more relaxed in the chair, defeated and barely moving.
I loved my daughter. I haven't seen her since Thanksgiving, and that's a God's truth. The puppy,
Benton cues her, and Lucy considers ripping the receiver out of her ear.
You think someone killed your daughter because you're a snitch for Homeland Security?
Lucy knows better, but she is going to get him.
Come on, Frank, tell the truth. Don't make it worse for yourself.
Someone killed her, he repeats. I don't believe it.
Believe it?
That can't be.
Who came to your house to play the game? You know Edgar Allan Pogue, the guy living behind your house? Living where Mrs. Arnett used to live?
I knew her, he says. She was a patient of mine. Hypochondriac. Damn pain in the ass, really. This is important,
Benton says, as if Lucy doesn't know.
He's confiding. Be his friend.
Your patient in Richmond?
Lucy asks Dr. Paulson. And the last thing she wants is to be his friend. But she softens, acts interested.
When?
When? Oh, God, forever ago. Actually, I bought a Richmond house from her. She owned a number of houses in Richmond. At the turn of the century, her family owned the whole damn block. Was one big estate. Got divided up for members of her family, eventually for sale. I bought our house from her, for a bargain. Some bargain.
Sounds like you didn't like her much, Lucy says, as if she and Dr. Paulson get along fine, as if he wasn't molesting her a few minutes ago.
She come by the house, my office, whenever she wanted. Pain in the ass, always complaining.
What happened to her?
Died 8-10 years ago, long time ago.
Of what? Lucy asks. What did she die of?
She'd been sick, had cancer. She died at home.
Details,
Benton says.
What do you know about it? Lucy asks. She alone when she died? She have a big funeral?
Why are you asking all this?
Dr. Paulson sits in the chair looking at her. But he is feeling better because she is friendly. It's obvious.
It might be related to Jilly. I know things you don't. Let me ask the questions.
Careful,
Benton warns her.
Keep him close.
Well, ask me then, Dr. Paulson says snidely.
Did you go to her funeral?
I don't remember her having one.
She must have had a funeral, Lucy says.
She hated God, blamed him for all her aches and pains, for nobody wanting to be around her, which was understandable if you knew her. What a disgusting old lady, just intolerable. Doctors don't get paid enough to treat people like her.
She died at home? She was that sick with cancer and died all alone at home? Lucy asks. She was in hospice?
No.
She's a wealthy woman and dies all alone at home. No medical care? Nothing?
More or less. Why does all this matter?
His eyes move around the examination room, and he is alert and more confident.
It matters. You're making things better for yourself.
A lot better, Lucy assures him and threatens him at the same time.
I want to see Mrs. Arnett's medical records. Show them to me. Pull her up on your computer.
I would have purged her record. She's dead.
His eyes mock her.
Funny thing about dear Mrs. Arnett is she donated her body to science because she didn't want a funeral, because she hated God, and that was that. I guess some poor med student had to work on the old bitch. I used to think about that from time to time and feel sorry for the poor med student whose luck of the draw was to get her withered, ugly old body.
He is calmer and more sure of himself, and the more confident he gets, the more Lucy's hatred rises like bile.
The puppy,
Benton says in her ear.
Ask him.
What happened to Jilly's puppy?
Lucy asks Dr. Paulson.
Your wife says their puppy disappeared and you had something to do with it.
She's no longer my wife, he says, his eyes hard and cold, and she's never had a dog.
Sweetie,
Lucy says. He looks at her, and something glints in his eyes.
Where's Sweetie?
Lucy asks.
The only sweetie I know is me and Jilly, he says, a smirk on his face.
Don't be funny, Lucy warns him. There's nothing funny about any of this.
Suze calls me sweetie. She always has, and I call Jilly sweetie.
That's the answer,
Benton says.
That's enough. Get out.
There's no puppy, Dr. Paulson says. That's a lot of shit.
He leans into the conversation more, and she sees what is coming.
Who are you?
He asks.
Give me the pen.
He gets up from the chair.
You're just some stupid little girl sent in to sue me, aren't you? Think you're getting money. You see how foolish this is, don't you? Give me the pen.
Lucy stands with her arms by her sides, her hands ready.
Move out,
Benton says.
Now. So a couple of you whirly girls get together? Think you're going to get a few bucks?
He stands before her, and she knows what is about to happen.
Move out, Benton says emphatically. It's over.
You want the camera?
Lucy asks Dr. Paulson.
You want the micro-recorder?
She has no recorder. Benton does.
You really want them?
We can just pretend this never happened,
Dr. Paulson says, smiling.
Give them to me. You got the information you wanted, now didn't you? So we'll just forget everything else. Let me have them.
She taps the cellular interface that is clipped to a belt loop, the wire connected to it running through a tiny hole inside her flight suit. She pushes a switch, turning off the interface. Benton's screen just went blank. He can hear and talk, but he can't see.
Don't,
Benton says in her ear.
Get out, now.
Sweetie,
Lucy mocks Dr. Paulson.
What a joke. Can't imagine anybody calling you sweetie. That's sickening. You want the camera, the recorder? Come and get them.
He rushes at her and runs right into her fist, and then his legs go out from under him, and he is on the floor with a grunt and a cry, and she is on his back, a knee pinning his right arm, her left hand pinning his left arm. His arms are wrenched and trapped painfully behind his back.
"Let me go," he yells. "You're hurting me." "Lucy, no."
Benton is talking, but she isn't listening. She grips the back of Dr. Paulson's hair, and she is breathing hard and tastes her rage, and she lifts his head by his hair.
"Hope you had a nice time today, sweetie," Lucy says, jerking his head by the hair. "I should beat your fucking brains out. You molest your own daughter? You let other perverts do it when they came to your house for sex games? You molest her in her own bedroom right before you moved out last summer?"
She presses his head against the floor and holds it hard as if she is drowning him in the white tile floor. His cheek is squashed against the floor.
"How many lives have you ruined, you motherfucker?"
She bangs his head on the floor, hard enough to remind him she could smash his brains out. He grunts and cries out.
"Lucy, stop!"
Benton's voice pierces her eardrum.
"Move out!"
She blinks, suddenly aware of what she is doing. She can't kill him. She must not kill him. She gets off him. She starts to kick him in the head, but stops her foot. She breathes hard, sweating, backing off, wanting to kick him, wanting to beat him to death, and she could. Easily.
"Don't move,"
she snarls, backing away from him, her heart flying as she realizes just how much she wants to kill him.
"Lie right there and don't move. Don't move."
She reaches toward the countertop and snatches up her bogus FAA forms, then backs up to the door and opens it. He stays down and doesn't move, his face against the floor. Blood drips from his nose and is bright red against the white tile.
"You're finished,"
she says to him from the doorway, wondering where the plump woman is, the secretary, glancing out toward the stairs and seeing no one. The house is perfectly quiet, and she is alone inside it with Dr. Paulson, just the way he planned.
"You're finished. You're lucky you're not dead,"
she says, shutting the door behind her. Chapter 47. Along the narrow streets inside the training camp, five agents armed with Beretta Storm 9mm rifles with Bushnell scopes and tactical lights move in from different directions on a small stucco house with a cement roof. The house is old and in poor repair, and the small overgrown yard is gaudy with inflated Santas, snowmen, and candy canes. Palm trees are sloppily strung with multicolored lights. Inside the house, a dog barks nonstop. The agents wear their Storms on tactical slings that angle across their body and hold the muzzles down at a 40-degree angle. Dressed in black, they are not wearing body armor, which is unusual on a raid. Rudy Musil waits calmly inside the stucco house, behind a high barricade of turned-over tables and upended chairs that block the narrow doorway leading into the kitchen. He is dressed in camouflage pants and tennis shoes, and armed with an AR-15 that is not a lightweight search weapon like the Storm, but a high-power combat weapon with a 20-inch barrel that can take out the enemy up to 300 yards away. He doesn't need a weapon to clear the house, because he is in the house. He moves from the doorway to the broken window over the sink, looking out. He sees movement behind a dumpster about 50 yards from the house. He props the AR-15 on the edge of the sink and rests the barrel on the rotting windowsill. Through the scope, he finds his first prey crouching behind the dumpster, just a sliver of his black-clothed body exposed. Rudy squeezes the trigger, and the rifle cracks and the agent screams, and then another agent darts out of nowhere and hits the dirt behind a palm tree, and Rudy shoots him, too. That agent doesn't scream or make any sound that Rudy can hear, and he moves from the window to the barricade in the doorway, angrily kicking and tossing tables and chairs out of his way. He breaks through his own barricade and rushes to the front of the house and smashes out the living room window and begins firing. Within 5 minutes, all five agents have been slammed with rubber bullets, but they keep on coming until Rudy orders them over the radio to halt. "You guys are worthless," he says into his radio as he sweats inside the raid house that the training camp uses for simulated combat. "You're dead, every one of you. Fall in." He steps outside the front door as the agents in black walk toward the yard, festively decorated for Christmas, and Rudy has to give them credit. At least they are not showing their pain, and he knows they hurt like hell where the rubber bullets slammed into their unprotected bodies. You get hit enough times with rubber bullets, and you want to break down and cry like a baby. But at least this batch of new recruits is hard-faced and able to take the pain. Rudy presses a small remote control, and the CD of the barking dog inside the house stops. Rudy stands in the doorway and looks at the agents. They are breathing hard and sweating and angry with themselves.
"What happened?" Rudy asks. "The answer's easy."
"We fucked up," an agent replies.
"Why?" Rudy asks, the AR-15 down by his side. Sweat streams down his muscular bare chest, and veins rope along his tan, chiseled arms.
"I'm looking for one answer. You did one thing, and that's why you're dead."
"We didn't anticipate you having a combat rifle. Maybe assumed you had a handgun,"
an agent offers, wiping her dripping face on her sleeve and breathing hard from nerves and physical exertion.
"Never assume," Rudy replies loudly to the group. "I might have a fully automatic machine gun in here. I might be firing 50-caliber rounds in here. But you made one fatal mistake. Come on, you know what it is. We've talked about it."
"We faced off with the boss," someone says, and everybody laughs.
"Communication," Rudy says slowly. "You, Andrews."
He looks at an agent whose black fatigues are covered with dirt. "As soon as you took a round in your left shoulder, you should have alerted your comrades that I was firing from the kitchen window behind the house. Did you?"
"No, sir."
"Why not?"
"I guess I've never been shot before, sir."
"Hurts, don't it?"
"Like hell, sir."
"That's right. And you weren't expecting it."
"No, sir. Nobody said we get shot with live rounds."
"And that's why we do it down here at Camp Pain and Misery," Rudy says. "When something bad happens in real life, we usually haven't been briefed first, now have we? So you got hit, and it hurt like hell and scared the shit out of you. And as a result, you didn't get on the radio and warn your comrades. And everybody got killed." "Who heard the dog?"
"I did," several agents say.
"You got a fucking dog barking like holy hell," Rudy replies impatiently. "Did you get on the radio and let everybody know? The damn dog is barking, so the guy in the house knows you're coming. A clue, maybe?"
"Yes, sir."
"The end," Rudy dismisses them. "Get out of here. I gotta get cleaned up for your funerals."
He steps back into the house and shuts the door. His two-way radio phone vibrated twice from his belt while he was talking to the recruits, and he checks to see who is trying to get hold of him. Both calls are from his computer geek, and Rudy calls him back.
"What's up?" Rudy asks. "Looks like your guy's about to run out of prednisone. Last filled a prescription 26 days ago to CVS.
And he gives Rudy the address and phone number.
"Problem is," Rudy replies, "I don't think he's in Richmond. So now we've got to figure out where the hell he might get his drugs next, assuming he'll bother."
"He's been filling his prescription every month at the same Richmond pharmacy, so it looks like he needs the stuff, or thinks he does."
"His doc?"
"Dr. Stanley Philpott."
He gives Rudy that phone number.
"No record of him filling a prescription anywhere else? Not in South Florida?"
"Just Richmond, and I looked nationally. Like I said, he's got 5 days left of the most recent prescription, and then he's out of luck. Or should be, unless he's got some other source."
"Good job," Rudy says, opening the refrigerator in the kitchen and grabbing a bottle of water. "I'll follow up."
Chapter 48. Private jets look like toys against giant white mountains that soar around wet black pavement. The linesman in a jumpsuit and earplugs waves orange cones, directing a beach jet as it taxis slowly, its turbine engines whining. From inside the private terminal, Benton can hear Lucy's plane arrive. It is Sunday afternoon in Aspen, and rich people with fur coats and baggage of the rich move around behind him, drinking coffee and hot cider near the huge fireplace. They are heading home and complain about delays because they have forgotten the days of commercial travel, if they ever knew about those days. They flash gold watches and large diamonds, and they are tan and beautiful. Some travel with their dogs, which, like their owners' private planes, come in all shapes and sizes, and are the best money can buy. Benton watches the beach jet's door open and the steps lower. Lucy skips down them carrying her own bags, moving with athletic grace and confidence and without hesitation, always knowing where she's going, even if she has no right to know. She has no right to be here. He told her no. He said when she called,
"No, Lucy, don't come here. Not now. This isn't the time."
They didn't argue. They could have, for hours. but neither of them has a temperament suited for long, loopy descents filled with illogical outbursts and redundancies. Not anymore, they don't. So they tend to fire quick, rapid rounds and put an end to it. Benton isn't sure it pleases him that as time passes he and Lucy have more traits in common, but apparently they do. It is becoming more apparent all the time, and the analytical part of his brain that sorts and stacks and dispatches without pause has already considered, or maybe concluded, that the similarities between Lucy and him could explain his relationship with Kay, as much as it can be explained. She loves her niece intensely and unconditionally. He has never quite understood why Kay loves him intensely and unconditionally. Now maybe he's beginning to know. Lucy shoves the door open with a shoulder and walks in, a duffel bag in each hand. She is surprised to see him.
Here, let me help you.
He takes a bag from her.
I didn't expect to see you here, she says.
Well, I'm here. Obviously, you are. We'll make the best of it.
The rich in their animal pelts and animal hides probably think Benton and Lucy are an unhappy couple. He, the wealthy older man, she, the beautiful young girlfriend or wife. It crosses his mind that some people might think she is his daughter, but he doesn't act like her father. He doesn't act like her lover, either. But if he had to wager a bet, he would bet that observers assume they are a typical rich couple. He wears neither furs nor gold, and he doesn't look conspicuously rich, but the rich know other rich, and he has a rich air about him because he is rich. Very rich. Benton had many years of living quietly and invisibly. He had many years to accumulate nothing but fantasies and schemes and money.
I have a rental car,
Lucy says as they walk through the terminal, which looks very much like a small rustic lodge of wood, stone, leather furniture, and Western art. Out front is a huge bronze sculpture of a rampant eagle.
Pick up your rental car, then,
Benton tells her, his breath a pale smoke drifting on the bright, sharp air.
I'll meet you at Maroon Bell's.
What?
She stops on the circular drive out front, ignoring the valets in their long coats and cowboy hats. Benton's hard, tan, handsome face looks at her. His eyes smile first, then his lips smile a little, as if he is amused. He stands on the drive near the huge eagle and looks her up and down. She is dressed in boots, cargo pants, and a ski jacket.
I've got snowshoes in the car, he says.
His eyes are fixed on hers, and the wind lifts her hair, which is longer than when he saw her last, and a deep brown touched by red as if it has been touched by fire. The cold stings color into her cheeks, and he has always thought that looking into her eyes must be something like looking into the core of a nuclear reactor, or inside an active volcano, or seeing what Icarus saw when he flew into the sun. Her eyes change with the light and her volatile moods. Right now they are bright green. Kay's are blue. Kay's are just as intense, but in different ways. Their varying shades are more subtle, and can be as soft as haze or as hard as metal. Right now he misses her more than he knew he did. Right now Lucy has brought back his pain with a fresh cruelty.
I thought we'd walk and talk,
he tells Lucy, walking toward the parking lot as he announces intentions that are not negotiable.
We need to do that first. So I'll meet you at Maroon Bell's, up there where they rent the snowmobiles, where the road's closed off. Can you handle the altitude? The air's thin.
I know about the air, she says to his back, as he walks away from her.
Chapter 49. On either side of the pass are snow-covered mountains, and the late afternoon shadows are settling low and wide, and in the high ridges to the right of them it is snowing. There's no use skiing or shoeing past 3:30, because darkness comes early in the Rockies, and by now the road they are on is freezing over and the air is biting.
We should have headed back sooner,
Benton says, stabbing a ski pole ahead of his leading snowshoe.
The two of us are dangerous together. We never know when to quit.
Not content to turn back after the fourth avalanche marker where Benton had suggested they stop, they kept shoeing steadily uphill toward Maroon Lake, only to turn back not even half a mile before they could see it. As it is, they'll barely make it to their cars before it is too dark to see, and they are cold and hungry. Even Lucy is worn out. She won't admit it, but Benton can tell the altitude is getting to her. She has slowed down considerably and is having a hard time talking. For a few minutes, their snowshoes scrape over the crusting snow on Maroon Creek Road, and the only sound is their scraping and crunching, and their poles puncturing the glazing rutted snow. Their breathing is quite smoky now, but quiet enough, and it is only now and then that Lucy takes in a lot of air and blows it out. The more they talked about Henry, the more they walked, and they've gone too far for their own good.
"I'm sorry,"
Benton says, the aluminum frame of his shoe clanking ice.
"I should have turned us around sooner. I don't have any more protein bars or water."
"I'll make it," says Lucy, who under ordinary conditions can keep up with him just fine, can more than keep up with him.
"Those little planes. I didn't eat. I've been running and biking, doing a lot. I didn't think this would bother me."
"Every time I come here, I forget,"
he replies, looking around at the snowstorm to their right as it sinks lower over the white peaks, slowly moving toward them like fog. It is maybe a mile off and 1,000 feet above them, if that. He hopes they make it back to their cars before the snow moves in. The road is easy to follow, and there is no way to go except down. They won't die.
"I won't forget," Lucy says, breathing hard. "Next time, I'll eat. Maybe not chew the first hour I get here, either."
"Sorry,"
he says again.
"Sometimes I forget you have limitations. It's easy to forget that."
"I seem to have a lot of them lately."
"If you had asked me, I would have told you it would happen."
He reaches his pole ahead and steps.
"But you wouldn't have believed me."
"I listen to you."
"I didn't say you don't listen. I said you don't believe. In this case, you wouldn't have."
"Maybe so. How much farther? What marker are we on?"
"I hate to tell you, but only 3. We've got a few miles to go,"
Benton replies. He looks up at the thick, smoky storm. In just a few minutes, it has moved lower, and the top half of the mountains has vanished into it, and the wind has picked up.
"It's been like this since I got here," he says.
"Snows almost every day, usually late in the day, 5 or 6 inches. When you become the target, you can't be objective. As warriors, we tend to objectify those we pursue the same way they objectify their victims. It's different when we are the ones objectified, when we are the victims. And to Henry, you are an object. As much as you hate the word, you are a victim. She objectified you before you even met her. You fascinated her, and she wanted to possess you. In a different way, Pogue has objectified you too, but for his own reasons, different ones from Henry's reasons. He didn't want to sleep with you or live your life or be you. He just wants you to hurt."
"You really believe he's after me and not Henry?"
"Yes, I do. You are the intended victim. You are the object."
His words are punctuated with stabs of the ski poles and clanks of the shoes.
"You mind if we rest for a minute?"
He doesn't need to, but he's sure she does. They stop and lean forward in their snowshoes, leaning on their poles, breathing in big puffs of white air, and watching the snowstorm suffocate the mountains to their right about a mile off and close to their own altitude now.
"I give it less than half an hour,"
Benton says, taking off his sunglasses and tucking them into a pocket of his ski jacket.
"Trouble coming," Lucy says. "Kind of symbolic."
"One of the good things about coming out here or to the ocean. Nature puts things in perspective and has a few things to say,"
he replies, as he watches the gray, foggy storm smothering the mountains, knowing that inside the clouds it is snowing hard, and soon enough it will be doing that where they are.
"Trouble is coming. I'm afraid you're right. He's going to do something else if he isn't stopped."
"I hope he tries it with me."
"Don't hope that, Lucy."
"I hope it," she says,
and she starts walking again.
"The nicest thing he could do for me is try it on me. It will be the last thing he tries."
"Henry's pretty capable of taking care of herself,"
he reminds her, as he takes big, sure steps, planting one shoe, then the other, into the crusting snow.
"Not as capable as I am. Not close. Did she tell you what she did at the training camp?"
"I don't think so."
"Using the Gavin De Becker style of simulated combat, we're pretty savage," she replies. "None of the trainees are told what to expect, appropriately, because in real life, we don't know what to expect. So, after about the 3rd time of sicking the canines on them, they get a little surprise. The dogs come and lunge for them, only this time, they don't have the muzzles on. Of course, Henry had on the padding, but when she realized the dog wasn't muzzled, she totally freaked out, screamed, started running, got knocked down. She was crying and half crazy and said she was quitting."
I'm sorry she didn't. There's a second marker.
He holds up a ski pole, pointing at an avalanche marker painted with a large 2.
She got over it, Lucy says as she steps in tracks made earlier, because it is easier. She got over the rubber bullets, too, but she didn't like that SIMCOM much either.
You'd have to be crazy to like it.
I've had a few crazies come through who did. Maybe I'm one of them. They hurt like hell, but it's a rush. Why are you sorry she didn't quit? Do you think she should? I mean, well, I know I should fire her.
Fire her for being attacked in your house?
I know. I can't fire her. She'll sue me.
Yes, he says. I think she should quit. Hell yes.
He looks at her as he pulls ahead.
When you hired her away from LAPD, your vision was as covered up as the mountains over there.
He indicates a storm.
Maybe she was a good enough cop, but she's not cut out for your level of operation, and I hope to hell she quits before something really bad happens.
Right, she says ruefully in a puff of frozen breath. Really bad.
No one got killed.
So far, Lucy replies. God, this is getting to me. You do this every day?
Just about, time permitting.
Running half marathons is easier.
If you run where there's oxygen in the air, Benton says. There's the number one marker. One and two are close together, you'll be happy to know.
Pogue doesn't have a criminal record. He's just some loser. I can't believe it, Lucy says. Some loser who worked for my aunt. Why? Why me? Maybe it's her he's really after. Maybe he blames Aunt Kay for his health problems and God knows what.
No,
Benton replies.
He blames you.
Why? That's crazy.
Yes, more or less, it's crazy. You fit into his delusional thinking. That's all I can tell you, Lucy. He's punishing you. He was probably punishing you when he went after Henry. We can't know what goes through a mind like his. His logic is all his own, nothing like ours. I can tell you he's psychotic, not psychopathic. Impulse-driven, not calculating. Delusional with magical thinking. That's about all I can tell you. Here it comes, he says, and tiny flakes of snow suddenly are swirling around them.
Lucy lowers her goggles as gusts of wind rock aspen trees finely stenciled in dark shades of gray against the white mountains. The snow hits fast, and is a small, dry snow, and the wind is a crosswind that shoves them sideways as they move one snowshoe in front of another, picking their way along the frozen road. Chapter 50. Outside, the snow is piled high in the branches of the black spruce and in the crooks of the aspen trees. From her third-story window, Lucy hears a crunch of ski boots on the crusty sidewalk below. The St. Regis is a sprawling red-brick hotel that reminds her of a dragon crouched at the base of Ajax Mountain. The gondolas have not come to life yet at this early hour, but people have. The mountains block the sun, and dawn is a blue-gray shadow with no sound except the cold, crunching steps of skiers on their way to the slopes and the buses. After their crazy trek up Maroon Creek Road yesterday afternoon, Benton and Lucy got into their separate vehicles and went their separate ways. He did not want her to come to Aspen to begin with, and he certainly never intended for Henry, whom he scarcely knew, to end up here. But that is life. Life brings with it strangeness and surprises and upsets. Henry is here. Now Lucy is here. Benton said Lucy could not stay with him, understandably. He does not want her to cripple the progress he might be making with Henry, what little he might be making if he has made any progress with her. But today Lucy will see Henry, when it suits Henry. 2 weeks have passed, and Lucy can't stand it anymore, can't stand the guilt and the unanswered questions. Whatever Henry is, Lucy needs to see it for herself. As the morning becomes lighter, everything Benton did and said is clear. First, he wore Lucy out in thin air, where it was hard for her to say too much too soon or give vent to her fear-driven fury. Then, for all practical purposes, he sent her to bed. She isn't a child, even if he seemed to treat her like one yesterday, and she knows he cares. She's always known. He has always been good to her, even when she hated him. She digs inside a duffel bag for a pair of stretch ski pants, a sweater, long silk underwear, and socks, and lays them on the bed next to her 9mm Glock pistol with tritium sights and magazines that hold 17 rounds, a gun she chooses when routine indoor self-protection is on her mind, when she wants a close-contact gun with firepower, not knockdown power, because she wouldn't want to shoot a 40 or 45 caliber bullet or a high-power rifle round inside a hotel room. She hasn't figured out what she'll say to Henry, or how she'll feel at the sight of her. Don't expect anything good, she thinks. Don't expect her to be happy to see you or to be nice or polite. Lucy sits on the bed and pulls off her sweatpants and grabs her T-shirt, snatching it off over her head. She pauses in front of the full-length mirror, looking at herself, and making sure she isn't allowing age or gravity to get the best of her. They haven't, and they shouldn't, because she isn't quite 30. Her body is muscular and lean, but not boyish, and she really has no complaint about her physical self, but experiences an odd sensation whenever she studies her reflection. Then her body becomes a stranger, different on the outside from what she is inside. Not less or more attractive, just different from how she feels. And it drifts through her thoughts that no matter how many times she makes love, she will never know how her body feels, how her touch feels to her lover. She wishes she knew, and is glad she doesn't.
You look all right, she thinks, walking away from the mirror. You look good enough to get by, she thinks as she steps into the shower. The way you look isn't going to matter today, not one bit. You aren't going to be touching anyone today, she tells herself as she turns on the water. Or tomorrow, or the next day. God, what am I going to do? She says out loud as hot water blasts against marble and splashes the glass door and drives down hard on her flesh. What have I done, Rudy? What have I done? Please don't quit on me. I promise I'll change. She has secretly cried in showers for almost half her life.
When she started out in the FBI, she was a teenager who got summer jobs and internships because of her influential aunt. And she had no business living in a dormitory at Quantico and shooting guns and running obstacle courses with agents who did not panic or cry, or at least she never saw them panic or cry. She assumed they never did. She believed many myths back then, because she was young and gullible and in awe. And now she may know better, but her early programming twisted her in a way that can't be straightened. If she cries, and she rarely does, she cries alone. When she hurts, she hides it. She is almost dressed when she becomes aware of the silence. Quietly swearing and suddenly frantic, she digs in a pocket of her ski jacket and finds her cell phone. The battery is dead. Last night she was too tired and unhappy to think about her phone, and she forgot it and left it in her pocket. And that isn't like her. That is so unlike her. Rudy doesn't know where she is staying. Neither does her aunt. Neither of them knows the alias she is using, so even if they tried the St. Regis, they wouldn't find her. Only Benton knows where and who she is, and for her to cut Rudy off like this is unthinkable and unprofessional, and he will be furious. Of all times, now was not the time to push him farther away. If he quits, what then? She trusts no one else she works with the way she trusts him. Finding the charger, she plugs in the phone and turns it on. And she has 11 messages, most of them left since 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, most of them from him.
I thought you dropped off the map, Rudy says the instant he answers. I've been trying to get you for 3 hours. What are you doing?
Since when don't you answer the phone? Don't tell me it's not working. I don't believe it. That phone works anywhere, and I've been trying you on the radio, too. You've had the damn thing turned off, haven't you?
Calm down, Rudy, she says. My battery went dead.
The phone, the radio don't work when the battery's dead. I'm sorry.
You didn't bring a charger?
I said I'm sorry, Rudy.
Well, we have a little bit of intelligence. It would be good if you could get back here ASAP.
What's going on?
Lucy sits down on the floor near the socket where her phone is plugged in.
Unfortunately, you're not the only one who got a little present from him. Some poor old woman got one of Pogue's chemical bombs. Only she wasn't so lucky.
Jesus, Lucy says, shutting her eyes.
A waitress at a sleazy bar in Hollywood that's right across the street from a Shell station where, guess what? They sell big gulps in cat-in-the-hat cups. The victim's burned pretty bad, but is going to make it. Apparently he's been coming into the place she works, the Other Way Lounge. Ever heard of it?
No,
she says almost inaudibly, thinking of the burned woman.
Jesus,
she mutters.
So we're canvassing the area. I've got some of our people out. Not the recruits. They ain't the sharpest knives in the drawer. These ones aren't.
Jesus, is all she can think to say about it. Can anything go right?
They're going more right than they were. Two other things. Your aunt says Pogue might be wearing a wig. A long black curly wig. A dyed black human hair wig. I guess the mitochondrial DNA was going to be pretty funny, right? Probably come back to some hooker who sold her hair to a wig company so she could buy crack.
You just telling me this now? A wig?
Edgar Allan Pogue has red hair. Your aunt saw red hairs in the bed in his house, in the house where he was staying. A wig could explain the long, wavy, dyed black hairs recovered from Jilly Paulson's bed linens and from your bedroom and also the duct tape on the chemical bomb left in your mailbox. A wig would explain a lot of things, according to your aunt. We're also looking for his car. Turns out the old woman who died in the house where he's been staying, Mrs. Arnett, had a white 1991 Buick, and no one knows what happened to it after she died. The family never gave it a thought. Sounds like they never gave her a thought either. We think Pogue might be driving the Buick. It's still registered to Mrs. Arnett. It would be good if you come on back here ASAP. Probably not a good idea for you to stay in your house, though.
Don't worry, she says. I won't ever stay in that house again. Chapter 51. Edgar Allan Pogue closes his eyes. He sits in his white Buick in a parking lot off A1A, listening to what people call adult rock these days. He keeps his eyes shut and tries not to cough. Whenever he coughs, his lungs burn and he feels dizzy and cold. He doesn't know where the weekend went, but it went all right. The adult rock station says it's rush hour Monday morning. Pogue coughs, and tears fill his eyes as he tries to breathe deeply. He has caught a cold. He is certain he caught it from the red-haired waitress at the Other Way Lounge. She came close to his table when he was leaving Friday night. She came close, wiping her nose on a tissue, and she got much too close to him because she wanted to make sure he paid. As usual, he had to push back his chair and stand up before she bothered to check on him. The truth was, he would have liked another bleeding sunset and would have ordered one, but the red-haired waitress couldn't be bothered. None of them can be bothered. So she got a big orange, and that's what she deserved. The sun comes through the front windshield and is warm on Pogue's face as he sits behind the steering wheel, the seat pushed back, his eyes shut. He hopes the sun will cure his cold. His mother always said that sunlight has vitamins in it and cures just about everything, which was why when people get old, they move to Florida. That's what she told him.
Someday, Edgar Allan, you'll move to Florida. You're young now, Edgar Allan, but someday you'll be old and worn out like I am, like most people are, and you'll want to move to Florida. If only you had a respectable job, Edgar Allan. I doubt you'll be able to afford Florida the rate you're going.
His mother nagged him about money. She worried him to death about it. Then she died and left him enough to move to Florida someday if he wanted. And then he retired and started getting a check in the mail every 2 weeks. And the last check must be sitting in his post office box because he isn't in Richmond to pick it up. He has a little money even without his checks. For now, he has enough. He can still afford his expensive cigars, so he has enough. And if his mother were here, she would nag him about smoking with a cold, but he's going to smoke. He thinks about the flu shot he missed, all because he heard that his old building was being torn down and that the big fish had opened an office in Hollywood, in Florida. Virginia hired a new chief medical examiner, and next thing Pogue knew, they were going to tear the old building down so the city could build a parking deck, and Lucy was in Florida. And if Scarpetta hadn't abandoned Pogue in Richmond, there would have been no need for a new chief, and therefore the old building would be fine, because everything would have stayed the same, and he would not have been late for his flu shot and would have gotten one. Tearing down his old building wasn't right or fair, and no one bothered to ask him how he felt about it. It was his building. He still gets a paycheck every 2 weeks, and he still has his key to the back door, and he still works in the anatomical division, usually at night. He worked there all he wanted until he heard the building was coming down. He was the only one using the building. No one else cared about it in the least, and now he suddenly had to get his things out of there.
All those people he had down there in little dented boxes had to be moved late at night when no one could see him do it. What an ordeal. Going up and down the stairs, in and out of the parking lot, his lungs burning as ashes leaked everywhere. One box slid off the stack he was carrying and spilled on the parking lot, and it was very hard to pick up ashes that seemed lighter than air and blue everywhere. What an awful ordeal. It wasn't fair. And next thing he knew, a month had passed, and he was late for his flu shot, and there was no more vaccine. He coughs, and his chest burns, and his eyes tear up. And he sits very still in the sun, soaking in the vitamins, and he thinks of the big fish. He feels depressed and angry when he thinks of her. She knows nothing about him and never even said hello to him, and now he has stiff lungs because of her. He has nothing because of her. She has a mansion and cars that cost more than any house he's ever lived in, and she couldn't bother to say she was sorry the day it happened. In fact, she laughed. She thought it was funny when he jumped and gave out a little yelp like a little dog as he was walking out of the embalming room, and she rattled past riding a gurney. She was standing on a rung of the gurney, rattling past, laughing, and her aunt was standing by an open vat, talking to Dave about something going on with the General Assembly, some problem. Scarpetta never came down unless there was a problem. This particular day, and it was this same time of year, Christmas time, she brought the spoiled know-it-all Lucy with her, and he already knew about Scarpetta's niece. Everybody there did. He knew that she was from Florida. She lived in Florida, in Miami, with Scarpetta's sister. Pogue doesn't know all the details, but he knows enough, and he knew enough back then to realize that Lucy could soak in vitamins and not have anyone nag and complain that she would never do well enough to live in Florida. She already lived there, was born there, and did nothing to earn it. And then she laughed at Pogue. She rode by on the gurney and almost hit him when he was walking past, pushing an empty 50-gallon drum of formaldehyde on a dolly. And because of Lucy, he jumped and came to an abrupt halt, and the dolly tipped, and the drum toppled over and rolled, and Lucy clattered by on the gurney like a bratty kid riding a shopping cart in the grocery store. Only she wasn't a kid. She was a teenager, a very bratty, pretty, prideful 17-year-old, and Pogue remembers her age exactly. He knows her birthday. For years he has sent her anonymous sympathy cards on her birthday, in care of Scarpetta at the OCME, at the old 9 North 14th Street address, even after the building was abandoned. He doubts Lucy ever got them. That day, that fateful day, Scarpetta stood by the open vat, and she was wearing a lab coat over a very smart dark suit, because she had a meeting with the legislator, she told Dave, and was going to address whatever the problem was. She was going to talk to the legislator about some proposed cockeyed bill, and Pogue can't remember what it was, because at the time, the bill wasn't the point of anything. He takes a breath, and it rattles in his stiff lungs as he sits in the sun. Scarpetta was a very good-looking woman when she was dressed smartly like she was that morning. And it always pained Pogue to look at her when she wasn't looking at him, and he would feel a deep twinge that he couldn't define when he watched her from a distance. He felt something for Lucy, but it was different what he felt for her. He sensed the intensity of what Scarpetta felt for her, and that made him feel something for Lucy, but it was different. The empty drum made the most god-awful racket as it rolled across the tile, and Pogue rushed to grab it as it rolled right toward Lucy on the gurney. And it was never possible to get every drop of formaldehyde out of a 50-gallon metal drum, and the swill in the bottom was spilling and splashing as the drum rolled. Several drops hit his face as he grabbed the drum, and one drop went into his mouth, and he inhaled it. Then he was coughing and vomiting in the bathroom, and no one came to check on him. Scarpetta didn't. Lucy certainly didn't. He could hear Lucy through the closed bathroom door. She was riding the gurney again, laughing. No one knew that Pogue's life was broken at that precise moment. Broken for good. "Are you all right? Are you all right, Edgar Allan?" Scarpetta asked through the shut door, but she didn't come in. He has replayed what she said, replayed it so many times he is no longer certain he has her voice right, that he has remembered it right, exactly right. "Are you all right, Edgar Allan?"
"Yes, ma'am, I'm just washing up."
When Pogue finally emerged from the bathroom, Lucy's gurney go-cart was abandoned in the middle of the floor, and she was gone. And Scarpetta was gone. Dave was gone. Only Pogue was there, and he was going to die because of a single drop of formaldehyde that he could feel exploding and burning into his lungs like red-hot sparks, and nobody was there but him.
"So you see, I know all about it," he later explained to Mrs. Arnett,
when he was lining up 6 bottles of pink embalming fluid on the cart next to her stainless steel table.
"Sometimes you have to suffer in order to feel the suffering of others," he told Mrs. Arnett,
as he cut off sections of string from a roll on the cart.
"I know you remember how much time I spent with you when we talked about your paperwork and your intentions and what would happen to you if you went to MCV or UVA. You said you love Charlottesville, and I promised you I'd make sure you went to UVA since you love Charlottesville. I listened to you for hours in your house, didn't I? I came by whenever you called, at first because of the paperwork, then because you needed someone to listen, and were afraid your family would overrule you. They can't, I told you. This paperwork is a legal document. It's your last wishes, Mrs. Arnett. If you want your body to go to science and later to be cremated by me, your family can't do a thing about it."
Pogue fingers 6 brass and lead .38 caliber cartridges deep in his pocket as he sits in the sun inside the white Buick, and he remembers feeling the most powerful he'd ever felt in his life when he was with Mrs. Arnett. He was God when he was with her. He was the law when he was with her.
"I'm a miserable old woman and nothing works anymore, Edgar Allan," she said the last time they were together. "My doctor lives on the other side of the fence and he can't be bothered to check on me anymore, Edgar Allan. Don't ever get this old."
"I won't," Pogue promised.
"They're strange people on the other side of the fence," she told him with a wicked laugh,
a laugh that implied something.
"His wife is such a trashy thing, that one. Have you met her?"
"No, ma'am. Don't believe I have."
"Don't."
She shook her head, and her eyes implied something.
"Don't ever meet her."
"I won't, Mrs. Arnett. That's terrible your doctor can't be bothered. He shouldn't get away with that."
"People like him get what they deserve,"
she said from her pillow on the bed in the back room of the house.
"Take my word for it, Edgar Allan. People get what they dish out. I've known him for many a year, and he can't be bothered. Don't count on him signing me out."
"What do you mean?"
Pogue asked her. And she was so small and feeble in her bed, and covered up with many layers of sheets and quilts, because she said she couldn't get warm anymore.
"Well, I reckon when you go on, somebody has to sign you out, don't they?"
"Yes, they do. Your attendant doctor signs your death certificate."
One thing Pogue knew was how death worked.
"He'll be too busy. You mark my words. Then what? God throws me back?"
She laughed harshly, a laugh that wasn't funny.
"He would, you know. Me and God don't get along."
"I can certainly understand that," Pogue assured her. "But don't you worry," he added, knowing fully that he was God at that moment.
God wasn't God. Pogue was.
"If that doctor on the other side of your fence won't sign you out, Mrs. Arnett, you can trust I'll take care of it."
"How?"
"There are ways."
"You are the dearest boy I've ever known,"
she said from her pillow.
"Oh, how lucky your mother was."
"She didn't think so."
"Then she was a wicked woman."
"I'll sign you out myself," Pogue promised her. "I see those certificates every day, and half of them are signed by doctors who don't care."
"Nobody cares, Edgar Allan."
"I'll forge a signature if I have to. Don't you waste a minute worrying."
"You are such a love. What would you like of mine? It's in my will, you know, that they can't sell this house. I fix them but good. You can live in my house. Just don't let them know. And you can just take my car. Of course, I haven't driven it in so long, the battery's probably dead. The time is coming. You and I know it. What do you want? Just tell me. I wish I had a son like you."
"Your magazines," he told her. "Those Hollywood magazines."
"Oh, Lordy, those things on my coffee table? I ever tell you about the times I spent at the Beverly Hills Hotel and all those movie stars I'd see in the Polo Lounge and out around the bungalows?"
"Tell me again. I love Hollywood more than anything."
"That scoundrel husband of mine at least took me to Beverly Hills, I'll give him that, and we had some real times out there. I love the movies, Edgar Allan. I hope you watch movies. There's nothing like a good movie."
"Yes, ma'am, there's nothing like it. Someday I'm going to Hollywood."
Well, you should. If I weren't so old and worthless, I'd take you to Hollywood. Oh, what fun.
You're not old and worthless, Mrs. Arnett. Would you like to meet my mother? I'll bring her over sometime.
We'll have us a little gin and tonic and some of those bat-sized sausage quiches I make.
She's in a box, he told her.
Now that's a strange thing to say.
She passed on, but I have her in a box.
Oh, her ashes, you mean?
Yes, ma'am. I wouldn't part with them.
What a sweet thing. Nobody would give a damn about my ashes, I tell you. You know what I want done with my ashes, Edgar Allan?
No, ma'am.
Sprinkle them right over there on the other side of that goddamn fence.
She laughed her harsh laugh.
Let Dr. Possum put that in his pipe and smoke it. He couldn't be bothered, and I'll fertilize his lawn.
Oh, no, ma'am. I couldn't disrespect you like that.
You do it, I'll make it worth your while. Go in the living room and fetch my purse.
She wrote him a check for $500, money in advance for carrying out her wishes. After he cashed the check, he bought her a rose and wiped his hands on his handkerchief and was sweet with her, talking and wiping his hands.
Why do you wipe your hands like that, Edgar Allan?
She asked from the bed.
We need to take the plastic off that lovely rose and put it in a vase. Now why are you putting it in a drawer? She asked.
So you can keep it forever, he replied. Now, I need you to turn over for a minute.
What?
Just do it, he said. You'll see.
He helped her turn over, and she couldn't have weighed anything. And he sat on her back and tucked his white handkerchief in her mouth so she would be quiet.
You talk too much, he said to her. Now is not the time to talk, he told her. You should never have talked so much, he kept saying as he held her hands on the bed.
And he can still feel her jerk her head and weakly struggle beneath his weight as he took her breath away. When she went still, he let go of her hands and gently took his white handkerchief out of her mouth. And he sat on top of her when she was all quiet like that, making sure she stayed quiet and didn't breathe while he talked to her the same way he did the girl, the doctor's daughter, the pretty little girl whose father did things in that house, things Pogue should never have seen. He jumps and gasps as something sharp raps on his window. His eyes fly open and he coughs dryly, strangling. A big grinning black man is on the other side of the car window, rapping the glass with his ring and holding up a big box of M&Ms.
$5, the man says loudly through the glass. It's for my church.
Pogue cranks the engine and shoves the white Buick into reverse. End of disc 11.